The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul was fruitful for both sides. Both sides have agreed to finalize a joint comprehensive and strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan. This is a win-win deal, helping Kabul and Tehran boost their ties.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Iranian official has stressed the importance of expansion of ties between Kabul and Tehran through numerous ways, including increase of strategic partnership in different fields. He also stressed that bringing peace and political stability to Afghanistan under an Afghan-owned process is one of priorities of Tehran's regional policy.
We would remain backing Iraqi Afghan government and people in their fight for their for peace and stability and prosperity. We do consider peace and security in Afghanistan as our own peace and security, and we do consider the prosperity of Afghan people as the prosperity of Iranians. So we are certainly after a good, constructive, mutually beneficial relations with Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul comes as both countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have recently inaugurated the first joint railway project connecting western Afghanistan to eastern Iran as a proof of growing cooperation between both countries. Mutual ties between Kabul and Tehran are expanding as both sides are fighting U.S.-sponsored terrorism and sanctions. But the two countries, observers say, have proved that they will never set back against enemies. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Senior officials have told us, in the eyes of EU leaders, Donald Trump's credibility is now non-existent because of his refusal to concede the US presidential election. At their two-day summit in Brussels, which concluded on Friday, they adopted conclusions designed to reset relations with Washington.
We would like to further develop our partnership with the US in various sectors in the future. We want to stress the importance of multilateral cooperation on the international agenda. This is at the very core of the EU.
Critics say EU leaders lost a great deal of credibility themselves during the past 4 years over their failure to stand up to Trump.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars? Took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program. And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Political scientists claim the weakness of EU leaders to challenge Trump makes them complicit. Arguably, the bloc's greatest foreign policy achievement, the Iran nuclear deal, was left to flounder as Trump did everything to try and destroy it at the behest of Israel, critics argue. If Joe Biden can save the accord agreed by world powers in 2015, there would be many plus sides, experts say.
I hope we can switch as soon as possible on the question of security through prosperity on Middle East. And this is, I feel, the dream of all the Middle East people.
The EU continues to express optimism about the Joe Biden administration, which is due to take office next month.
We hope that this is going to be a more positive one. It has been a bumpy road in the last years, and there is a lot of hope on the working between the European Union and the US.
Many analysts warn if EU leaders don't get tougher, populism will continue to flourish in the West, and they might be seeing Trump back in the White House in 4 years' time. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a 0 hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her three-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warn these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If everybody were housed, that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, Right to Housing, because they do the right thing.
This building in the center of Paris is entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. A solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
The American regime is truly and severely suffering from a political, civil, and moral decline, and this is not mere analysis. What I am saying here is not merely an analysis. Rather, this is being acknowledged by themselves. This is being said by their spokespeople, writers, and thinkers inside the U.S. It is they who are saying this. They have written several books, published with a large circulation, bringing certain truths to light. I've read one of these books translated in Farsi. The book is filled with the proofs of this decline. If someone really reads the book, they see that from start to finish, the book speaks of the political decline of the U.S. with the moves made by the current U.S. president. Such an empire will not last long like this.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
It is evident that when one political system and regime reaches this point, it will not last long and it will be annihilated. Of course, if some of them hold office, they will destroy it sooner than the others, and there are some who make it last a little while longer should they hold office, but in any case, this is the truth of the matter. Their enmity towards us exists because we did not recognize their oppressive domination, because we did not give in to their demands and their policies in the region, because we rejected their policy on Palestine, and because we refused to accept their oppressive policies. They show us enmity, and this enmity continues in the present time. The only way to eliminate this enmity is to make them lose hope. In other words, the Iranian nation, the Iranian government, and the Islamic Republic should reach a point where the other side will lose all its hopes of delivering a serious blow to us. We should become strong.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to The Debate. I'm Kwabe Tahwa. Your French law on filming police has triggered a third weekend of protest. The controversial security bill would limit filming of the police. Why is it controversial? What faces the police are going to be blurred if they were filmed, so their identities would remain hidden. But doesn't that invite police to commit police brutality? Well, that's one of the questions we're going to be asking in this edition of The Debate. We'll also look at how France, under the French presidents, is losing some of the liberties and freedoms that the French have fought so hard for. First, let's cross on over to Paris and talk to our correspondent, Chris Den Hund. Chris Den Hund, tell us about, first of all, the protests, how those are going, and whether this bill is actually now being rethought in terms of some of its application, if that is indeed true.
Well, the protest is still going on every week, and there are three kinds of opposition against this bill. First of all, high-level government ministers are not pleased with the way this bill is written, so they want to rewrite. Macron himself said that he wants to look into it without saying concretely how he would change things. So that's not enough, clearly. A second opposition comes from the right-wing majority in the Senate, because the bill that has been voted in the French Assembly still has to be approved by the Senate, and the right-wing majority would like to rewrite. But the main opposition clearly comes from the street protesters and their supporters, mainly trade unions, human rights associations, who blame Macron and his government for being, for taking an authoritarian drift. And they say that Macron is fishing in the waters of the far right, especially on Islam, especially on on security issue, and also on the migrant issue. They say that another policy is possible, a more social policy is possible, and they take as a concrete example the situation in the hospitals, which is dramatic due to the COVID crisis, and they say due to the privatization, the ongoing privatization, people are overworked with burnout, so they ask the Macron's government to change his policy until that is not an. As this is still not done, the protest will go on. They want simply this law to be cancelled and to disappear.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Chris Den Hund, our correspondent there. All right, let's put some analysis into this. Journalist and political commentator Seb Mohsen Abbas joins us from London. Seb Mohsen Abbas, welcome. What is your reaction to this security bill? It's one of three, actually, that have been introduced, different types of bills, this one being the security bill. As our correspondent there indicated, people are very unhappy out on the streets, and there's a range in terms of the number of people participating from 100,000 to 500,000.
Well, first of all, let's set the context of this bill. This is not something that's popped out of nowhere. The post 9/11, if you like, paranoia and if you like, fear porn, quite frankly, which Europe and the West has engaged in, was done on the back of a so-called Islamic terrorist threat. That's been steadily used. That fear porn, if you like, has steadily been used to whittle away and erode civil liberties, to undermine the rights of people in Europe and the West. And it's been done rather like boiling frogs. You know, if you boil frogs, they'll jump out if you boil them too quickly. But you do it steadily and for over a long enough period, they'll kind of get used to the heat rising, and eventually they'll die before they can jump out because they won't have noticed the temperature change. So this is literally, I think, what neoliberalism as a policy, as an ideology, as a, if you like, a new religion, I'd call it, a secular neoliberal religion, which has emerged, of which Macron is very much an integral cornerstone of. So what he's doing is only implementing naturally what the neoliberalism doctrine and dogma dictates, because what they want is the erosion of power to the people, and they want greater power for the corporations. This is what Margaret Thatcher did in Britain. This is what Macron and his predecessors have been doing for the last 30 years. And of course, the public has been mizzled into thinking that they've got various benefits out of this neoliberal rise. The banks have been loaning money, etc. But of course, the penny is now dropping. In places like France, they're recognizing that the price you have to pay for neoliberalism and the so-called individualism and narcissism that's taken hold of vast sections of Western society is actually breakdown of community, it's breakdown of civil liberties, it's a breakdown of human rights, it's a breakdown of, the power that the people might have had and the transference of that power to corporate agencies, to the state. That exactly is what the clash now is emerging in Europe with the backdrop of COVID-19, which many commentators also now say is being used as a political weapon. The weaponization of COVID-19 is the follow-up to the weaponization of Islam as a fear tool for their people. But not everybody is buying into this. And now these clashes you see on the street are really part of the symptoms of that clash, I feel.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's see what Ian Williams thinks, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Ian Williams, welcome. First, your impression of this security bill and why such a backlash that's happening on the streets of Paris for the third consecutive week.
Well, I think there's an understandable backlash. We've seen all across the world that one of the few liberating items of technology that's come lately is the portable camera. That means that police depredations are dealt with in short order. The things can be seen and brought up in evidence. Because, you know, it's not, the police haven't suddenly in America, for example, started beating up and shooting black people. They've been doing it for centuries. It's just that now it gets recorded on camera, and the excuses that the police used to use are laughed out of court. In fact, even now with the cameras, they carry on doing it. I mean, the sense of impunity from law authorities is fairly shocking. And it's the same in France. I mean, there's never been the image in France that there was in Britain. It was just an image of the cozy Bobby on the corner saying hello to everybody. You know, the les flics, they were gendarmes, they were men at arms. They've always been treated as an occupying force. So it doesn't take much to get suspicion of the police to turn into hostility. And the idea that the police exclusively claimed nobody could film them while they were beating people up and breaking the law, at the same time they wanted the right to use drones and videos to take pictures of people going about their normal business, no, I was armed, citoyen. That's exactly what the French Revolution was all about. My surprise is that there's not more outrage about it. Even the middle classes in France would get upset about this type of behavior normally. But, you know, Macron obviously has a sort of complacent parliament where he can dragoon into supporting these things.
Okay. Well, we're going to discuss that a little bit down the road here in terms of what intentions Macron really has. But Simon Abbas, so just gathering from some of the statements that you made, if we're looking at a COVID-19 environment where there are shutdowns and mass unemployment as a result, a very charged environment, and also you had that terrorist attack that happened based on reports on how that went down, and just the economy in France perhaps double digits going into the new year, and then we could pile on maybe some of the protests that happened during the Yellow Vest movement protest on top of some of the most recent police brutality. Do you think that all these stacked up together has led to this outburst?
I think that's, of course, we're at the critical point where there is a tipping point, I think, that we're reaching very rapidly now, which began, I think, at the beginning of this century, maybe slightly before. But what we're seeing is really partly neoliberalism beginning to oppress the mainstream Western society, because they've been oppressing Muslims by excluding gradually the notion of Islam having any political say in places like France. So part of what Macron is still continuing is that process of finalizing neoliberalism's complete intolerance of Islam having a voice in Europe and the West. You can see that in the laws that he's beginning to roll out to tighten up and to distinguish between Islam, so-called Islam, and political Islam. These kind of debates are now going to the point where the laws are being implemented. And now that is important because the mindset of allowing this kind of greater legal oppression in the West has been slipped in the name of safety, in the name of security. And that's loosened the natural guard, I think, of ordinary liberally orientated Europeans used to certain values, certain kind of freedoms. And of course, because they've trained them into fearing the other through the migrants crisis, through the terrorism threat, through even the exaggeration, some would say, of climate change, perhaps, as well. There have been a lot of things that have, on an international level, been scaring people. And you see, at the heart of liberalism and what Macron believes in is also not just what the right wing talk about, because we see the right wing, they openly hate migrants, hate Muslims, hate foreigners, and would be quite happy for conflict to be ignited. However, this neoliberalism transcends the right wing. It permeates in conservative politics. It permeates the left-wing politics as well, some would say. And, you know, there are questions now being asked about Muslims, for instance, whether they can even have, the ability to participate rationally and peacefully within a European secular neoliberal political environment. So you see that actually this thing has been rolled out. And now what you're seeing, of course, the it was picked up by the yellow vests or the yellow jackets early on. They are the only ones in Europe who protested openly in France, because France has that tradition of protesting. You know, the agriculture trade, they'll defend that with protest. And it's more of a thing for the French people to do post-French Revolution. There's a whole tradition about protesting. Whereas within the rest of Europe, that hasn't happened. And of course, now we're seeing it again. The French are rising up. Of course, in order for this to be successful, you have to have the big powers acquiescing. Now, Macron acts for the moneylenders. He is a globalist. He is primarily there to protect the moneylenders' interests. And the moneylenders are creating an economic reset, of which Europe is going to be one victim. They're being downgraded economically, and that economic downgrading is what's going to cause these further conflicts, of which perhaps the Muslims will also become victims once there's trouble and strife. People will need others to blame, perhaps.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's another realm to this, another layer, perhaps, of a deeper insight into the matter, I'm guessing here, Ian Williams. I mean, if these, if the people behind Macron, the financial institutions or the large corporations, are actually in some form or another influencing Macron to enact these types of laws in order to make sure that people are controlled. Is that a possible scenario in order to control people?
Well, I think it is, but I'm not sure it's the big corporations doing this. I think it's a case of instinct. I mean, I agree that Islamophobia is a very serious weapon used by these people to get popular support for repression. But, I mean, a lot of what they've been doing in a lot of countries, it's not been specifically anti-Islamic. It's been against the underclasses in general, who they don't trust and who are growing rapidly. The deindustrialization of the Western world has led to a lot of people who don't feel that they have a secure part in society and are, let's say, you know, that they're more prone to join the rioting classes than that they used to be. And that's, I think what's happening is the law and order authorities, the public authorities, they always want more power. There's no police force that ever said, no, you can't give us more prisons, you can't give us more truncheons, no, you can't give us more cameras. They all want them. They want power. They want more intrusiveness. They want the ability to lift people because they blinked at them in the street. They want the possibility of arresting somebody who looks suspicious because they look suspicious. They've always wanted this, and what Macron and the others are doing is pandering to those wishes. Why on earth would this camera law come up, except unless you're obsessively thinking that that the police are a special class that need protection, that they're wrongly... I mean, you've seen this in New York, for example, and other cities, where the whole police force has turned out to rally against the mayor because he suggested they shouldn't go around shooting innocent black people on the streets. This makes him the target for them to shout outrage and to call upon the normal so-called middle-class citizens to back them. This is an attack upon the police. It's an attack upon you. It is fermenting deep divisions in society. But I don't think it's actually... I think the people with money are cleverer than this. They don't want to provoke this type of thing. They just want to carry on raking on the money. They want people to go out and borrow lots of money so they can buy lots of things and end up paying them both ways. That's mm-hmm. what they want. It's useful if they get the police as well. They might need them. But they'd far rather use more pacific means of pacification. Uh-huh. But this is a serious issue right across. The sense of impunity, which has been exacerbated, first of all, because it's been challenged. The police for years have felt they could get away with things, and now suddenly they can't. People were filming them. People were standing up to them because somebody with a camera feels like they're justified and they're armed, whereas before they might have said, yes, sir, no, sir, and carried on. Now they say, no, I'm going to take a film of you as you shoot that innocent person. And the police don't like that one little bit. It's challenging their privileges, which have included impunity.
Right.
They have the right to break the law and then break your head if you break the law. This is the way it's been, and they don't like this being overturned.
Simos and Abbas, this is about a month old, the headline I'm going to read to you. But I think it's worth noting in the context of what we're talking about here. And this headline reads, as Europe's governments lose control of COVID, revolt is in the air. And it specifically pointed out to what was happening in Naples, in Italy. And it also touched on France, and it also touched on Germany. And, well, there's been protests practically worldwide. Maybe France in Europe is setting the precedent in terms of the tighter control that it's having on the freedom and liberty of people. Do you think that is the case? Because obviously we're looking at the economic hardships, perhaps at the heart of this in some way or another, which leads to protests, which could lead to insecurity, violence, etc. And now the governments, like in France, are using this as a reason to clamp down.
Well, absolutely. I mean, of course, there is a debate to be had, and my good colleague obviously doesn't go quite as far as I would. But I mean, in terms of the organized nature of what's happening in Europe and the world, look, the thing is, when you know that a handful of people control half the same amount of wealth as half the rest of the planet, when you know 110 or 20 CEOs control 70% of world trade, when you know that the main organizations of the world, whether it's the Bank of International Settlements or whether it's any of these major institutions, are all funded and supported by this kind of cadre of very, very rich people, it's absolutely horrendously naive to expect that those people in that position of power wouldn't have something political to engage in with these powers. Now, the rise of China, let me just put something to you. China is being invested in by the same forces, the same funding money lenders, the same usurious institutions and corporate powers that raised the West. They're not any different. The ones who are investing, if you go and analyze carefully who's actually investing in the rise of China, I would say that it's a partnership between the immortals in China and the same old usual suspects which have been driving Western imperialism and hegemony for maybe a century or more, perhaps even. Now, that is a contention that you have to take into account, because if you aren't willing to accept that usury and the control of money and the economics factors in transnational corporate power and beyond, and those people who have the investments, then you're missing a very big part of the jigsaw. If you want to blame it only the symptoms, i.e. these puppets like Macron or Boris and the institutions, well, let me put that into context. Macron and Boris, all of them, are now going into debt. That debt that the COVID-19 crisis is bringing forward is being filled in by central banks. The central banks are wafting in money from nowhere. They're basically covering the gap. Only three or four years before the COVID crisis, we were being told here in the West that there was no money, that we couldn't bail out people because inflation would occur. Well, okay. The fact is there is an economic crisis that is going to hit hard, and it's being engineered as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so last question now, because I promised that I'm going to ask this. This goes to you, Ian Williams, and that is the intentions of Macron, because some are saying that it appears that he has this approach where he's going to impose these harsh orders, perhaps to clamp down on the protests, and at the same time maybe use some of the language and policies that some of the far right have done, like Marine Le Pen, in order for him to try to gain some of those, because he's such an unpopular president, for political gains. Do you think that is the case? If he can say that in less than a minute.
I think he is. Obviously, he's politically expedient, and he, like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, are appealing to the far right. But the other part is the social contract is broken down. We've had a banking crisis. We've had a COVID crisis. Government has explicitly given up the deal for the post-war era, which was there'll still be inequality, but your lifestyle will improve. We'll guarantee the basics for all the people in the Western society. Living standards will improve annually. Things will get better. Things have stopped getting better. Things have got worse, and the government has manifestly failed to protect its people against disease, against economic disaster, and all of the rest of the evils which now beset us. So authoritarianism is a natural way out. People are going to start getting restive, and as they have done, and the government is going to fight back on it, and they're going to appeal to the police and the reactionaries to do so, to defend them. And if that means that the police can beat up people with impunity, then they will. And okay. When the military come on the streets, they will as well.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank Chris Denhonda, correspondent of Paris, who joined us at the top of the hour of the debate. And Ian Williams there, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you. And journalist and political commentator Simonson Abbas from London. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From the COVID Taiwan entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in opening remarks to a climate summit, world leaders should declare states of climate emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. More than 70 world leaders addressed a one-day virtual gathering aimed at building momentum for much steeper cuts in planet warming carbon dioxide emissions on the fifth anniversary of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said via video conference on Saturday, 12th of December, "Can anybody still deny that we're facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached." Guterres said economic recovery packages launched in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic represented an opportunity to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon future, but warned this was not happening fast enough. We now present you an article written by Andrea Kutieru under the heading, "What 2020 Meant for Climate Change and the Environment." The article has been taken from the front page of the archdaily.com website. Please stay with us for more of Andrea Kutieru's article. First lockdown brought most of the world to a standstill, and many were quick to point out the silver lining. the significant drop in carbon dioxide emissions. However, this pollution reduction was short-lived, and past crises indicate that we might be standing at a crossroads when it comes to our climate goals. What has this unprecedented year meant for the efforts to curb climate change and protect the environment? As most economic activities have slowed down this year, especially in spring, a significant drop in greenhouse gas emissions was expected. According to the latest data, after several months of lockdown, severely reduced air traffic and closed construction sites, carbon emissions this year have only gone down 5.5% from 2019 levels. This not only illustrates how the pandemic's impact on climate change was overstated, but it paints an entirely new picture of the scale and effort required to shift the needle in terms of carbon emissions. As the pandemic unfolded, climate disruption continued apace. 2020 is on track to be one of the three warmest years on record, completing a streak of six consecutive years, each one hotter than the other. The year was also marked by extreme weather events, from the devastating bushfires in Australia and floods in Asia and the United States to severe droughts in South America, all consequences of climate change. The coronavirus pandemic has created a surge in plastic waste, adding to the already dire pollution problem. Naturally, this year's main priority has been mitigating the virus spread by implementing collaborative protective measures. However, the latter generated large quantities of waste, from disposable face masks and other personal protective equipment to increased use of acrylic screens, together with other single-use plastic items. For now, the technology for recycling acrylic screens is expensive and may generate harmful byproducts, and the personal protective equipment used in medical facilities is largely non-recyclable. 2020 has therefore meant a setback in the fight against plastic pollution, with negative consequences for wildlife. Challenging times usually spearhead structural changes. And that was the case with the 70s oil crisis, which marked a decrease in oil reliance and a shift towards natural gas, resulting in a drop in carbon emissions. Natural gas emits 50% to 60% less carbon dioxide than coal or oil. However, the 2008 financial crisis has failed to shift the global economy towards a carbon emission decrease. On the contrary, with countries struggling to recover, carbon dioxide emissions increased, especially in emerging economies, reaching an all-time high in 2010. As governments around the world are currently rolling out bailout policies attempting to save jobs, sustainability agendas might be easily and understandably sidetracked. Moreover, leading oil and gas companies around the world are taking advantage of the situation to demand government bailouts and the ease of environmental regulations, setting back the fight against climate change. Many academics and scholars and environmental scientists see this pandemic as an opportunity to redirect our industries. The aviation sector is already taking steps towards a more sustainable future, with Airbus announcing its so-called plan to have a hydrogen-powered commercial aircraft in service by 2035. However, transportation accounts for 14% of global emissions. In comparison, the architecture, engineering and construction (AEC) industry is responsible for a staggering 39% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Hence, the latter must make great strides in years to come and act with a sense of urgency. The production of steel and concrete, the two most common construction materials, generates 10% of the world's annual greenhouse gases. Therefore, there is a strong imperative to shift towards sustainable alternatives. Also, adaptive reuse, material recycling, and design for disassembly need to become standard practices, as is essential for architecture and the construction sector to embrace innovation quickly and programmatically. As of now, the current pandemic has mostly prompted architects to question spatial typologies. Still, it should also have put the industry's relationship with the environment into sharper focus. This year, the profession continued its attempts to fully commit to a standard set of principles and goals regarding climate change. However, as well-intended professional initiatives like Architects Declare might be, they are only as strong as the members' commitment. In this very case, the project's scope might be hindered by the recent withdrawal of the two largest members of the network, Zaha Hadid Architects and Foster & Partners, due to differences regarding specific architectural programs problematic to the fight against climate change. It goes to show that for effective change to happen, the profession needs policies and building codes mandating sustainable design principles. The architecture, engineering and construction industry can bring a significant contribution to curbing climate change in the following years. As scientists point to growing evidence that the same activities that contribute to climate change enable the emergence of new diseases, it's time for the industry to consider sustainable design, not as the right thing to do, but as the only option. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in opening remarks to a climate summit, world leaders should declare states of climate emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. More than 70 world leaders addressed a one-day virtual gathering aimed at building momentum for much steeper cuts in planet-warming carbon dioxide emissions on the fifth anniversary of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Antonio Guterres said via video conference on Saturday, 12th of December, "Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached." Guterres said economic recovery packages launched in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic represented an opportunity to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon future, but warned this was not happening fast enough. Guterres also noted, "So far, the members of the G20 are spending 50% more in their stimulus packages and rescue packages on sectors linked to fossil fuel production and consumption than on low-carbon energy." He said, "This is unacceptable. The trillions of dollars needed for COVID-19 recovery is money that we are borrowing from future generations," he added. "We cannot use these resources to lock in policies that burden future generations with a mountain of debt on a broken planet." On Friday, 11th of December, summit co-host Britain announced it would pledge an end to direct government support for overseas fossil fuel projects at the summit, aiming to spur similar moves by other countries to accelerate a shift to cleaner energy. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson told the summit that countries could work together to radically cut dependence on fossil fuels, change agricultural practices, and reverse the process by which for centuries humanity has been quilting the planet in a toxic tea cozy of greenhouse gases. Boris Johnson said, "At the same time, we can create hundreds of thousands of jobs, millions of jobs in fact, across the planet as we collectively recover from coronavirus." Diplomats were watching summit speeches for any sign of significantly stronger climate pledges from countries including the United States, China, India, and Japan.
Good morning. morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.